Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt. Alongside me, the man, the myth, the legend, Jack Piatelli. Jack, how are we doing?
Doing very well. Watched a lot of lacrosse over the weekend, some really good games, and had a really good weekend.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back in the studio with you after braving the cold and starting to warm up, which now we're just going to bring in a box guy.
Let's do that.
Let's do the opposite of what you think we're going to do. We got Mike French on the podcast today. What can you tell the listeners about him?
Well, he's really the first Canadian lacrosse player to ever come to the States and play Division I lacrosse, and he opened up the door for many other Canadians after. And to be honest, you know what? Everyone thinks it's Gary and Paul Gate that opened up the floodgates for other Canadians. Obviously, they were major influences on the game and for Canadians coming after. But Mike French was one of the best college lacrosse players to ever play and won two national championships at Cornell.
On those legendary Cornell teams with Eamon McEnany. Just, you know, people don't understand the history of the game, I don't think, enough. And I know that I'm going to learn a lot on this podcast from just being in it, you know, and I can't wait to talk to him. Let's get to him right now. Albany Firewolves partner, Mike French.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us today. It's really a pleasure having you on the New England Journal's podcast, Chasing the Goal. My co-host, Kyle Devitt. We're having a lot of fun and just wanted to talk a little bit about you and how you got started. And most people know you as a great lacrosse player, one of the best to ever come out of Cornell, but not many people know you were the captain of the 1978 Canadian team that lost to the U.S. team by a lot that season and then ended up beating them in overtime in the World Games in 1978. So tell us a little about that.
Well, you know, I'm obviously very proud of, you know, what happened in 1978. I was also on the 74 team when we played in Melbourne. I was the youngest player on the team. That team had, you know, I think two people that had outdoor experience. I think when we played in 1978 in Manchester, England, we probably had maybe a half a dozen guys that had field experience, maybe a few more, maybe seven or eight at most. And, you know, so we played certainly a hybrid type of a game. But the interesting thing was, as you probably know, Cornell, you know, was a pretty dominant team in the 70s. I was fortunate enough to be on many of those teams. But in 1978, we had a 42-game winning streak, still the longest in Division I lacrosse. And the coach of the U.S. team in Manchester was my coach, Richie Moran. And on that team, they had nine Cornell players. So I'm saying that I had mixed feelings because some of them are my best friends and they're my best friends to this day. And we upset them in overtime, you know, in a game which, you know, we just played really hard. It was raining. It was, you know, the conditions probably favored us because we weren't as experienced, and it came to an overtime game. And fortunately, we had a penalty in overtime. You know, it was funny because, you know, the Canadians, they don't mind shooting. And so whenever we had any kind of man up plays during the tournament, it was pretty hard to get the ball to go around the horn, as they say, one or two times before you went into some kind of a play. Well, in overtime, it went around the horn about four times because nobody wanted to screw up. And fortunately, Stan Cochran ran the play, cut down, and I was able to pass it to him and he put it in. So the result of the game was great, but it was monumental for Canadians that wanted to find an opportunity to go to the United States and get an education. And so one of the things I'm most happiest and proudest proud about is basically that opened the door. There was literally, there was like two Canadians, I think I was one of them, that were playing Division One lacrosse at that time. And that really opened the doors for recruiting. And, you know, obviously a lot of Canadians, there's, I don't know, there's probably hundreds now that are playing Division One, Two, and Three lacrosse in the States. I know most of the guys on my professional team have played in college in the United States and either, you know, earned a degree, which is good, and bettered their life. You know, that's what lacrosse has done for so many people, especially for me.
And we should say you're a partner in the Albany Fire Wolves franchise, formerly the Black Wolves. This is going to be one of those podcasts that I'm going to learn a lot, this podcast, because you and Jack have such a deep knowledge of the box game, and I've only covered it a little bit. I actually did the first story on the Black Wolves as a feature for Inside the Cross, and that's when I met you that many years ago at Mohegan Sun at that first game. And I had been to box games before, but that was a different experience. And, you know, we're talking all the way back in 1978, and I'm trying to pull us back to the forward. But I do want to go back and ask you this question and kind of make an observation. I think the lacrosse public believes that the Gate Brothers are the ones that started the Canadian trend. And now I'm seeing that it's you. Like, you were kind of the first trailblazer guy to come in and make a huge impact on the international stage and the Division I stage for the game of field lacrosse. How did you get recruited to Cornell? How did you end up there? What is the story behind that?
Well, I'll try to keep it brief, because I was living in a small town, St. David's, which had 500 people. I played hockey and lacrosse and some basketball, but that's really just outside of St. Catharines and Niagara Lake, not that far from the U.S. border. And I was recruited mainly through guys that were affiliated with hockey, at least to Cornell. I was recruited by some other schools, but mostly because of the hockey connection that I had. And, you know, a lot of the hockey people, you know, particularly at a place like Cornell, where most of the team was Canadian back then, that kind of was my intro. But when I told my parents, who neither had graduated from high school, and we pretty much were a blue collar family, that I was going to go on these recruiting trips, and I really wanted to go to this one at Cornell, they basically told me that it was a mistake. They said, your uncle Len, who was a foreman at General Motors, can get you in the queue to be on the night shift when you graduate. And everybody worked at either Domtar Paper Mill or General Motors in St. Catharines. And so to get on that list was a pretty hard thing to do, you know. And they said, you know, you're going to get paid well, you're going to be able to retire early, you're going to get a pension. And, you know, once you get on the night shift, then you'll get on the afternoon shift after a few years, and you maybe get on the day shift. So I said, you know what? I'm going to go on this trip to Ithaca. And so I went on the trip to Ithaca, and Coach Moran and some of the players that took me around, Bruce Arena, who ended up playing for the U.S. national team as U.S. soccer coach, and coaches now in New England soccer, and Jay Gallagher, and so they took me around. You know, I had a steak with a bone in it. I'd never seen that before. And I had a lobster, which I'd never had lobster before. And I go, wow, this is pretty good. And so I left there after spending some time with Coach Moran. And I really enjoyed the experience. I didn't know much about, I'd never played outdoor lacrosse, so I had no clue. I was using a wooden stick. And I said, you know what? My parents didn't really want to go, but if, you know, you can figure out a way to get me in the school. I had grade 13 back then. That was an option in Canada. So I had, you know, pretty reasonably good grades. And, you know, it's not, as long as it doesn't cost anybody anything, I think I can convince them that I want to go to college. And that all happened. And I ended up showing up there, you know, with my wooden stick, you know, my leather jacket, you know, with the patches all over it. And so I immediately met a pretty diverse group of student athletes. And quite frankly, it was fortunate that back then you had to play freshman, as you probably know, Jack, you know that. So I couldn't play varsity my freshman year. So we had a really good group of guys, and they remain my closest friends to this day that I played freshman with. We had an undefeated freshman team, and then, you know, went on to play varsity through 1976. And ultimately, the real benefit for me was that I got 2 degrees from Cornell. I got a master's degree and I got an undergraduate degree. And it was, you know, a total game changer for me, just like it's going to hopefully be for the Piatelli boys.
Mike, what's so impressive to me is you talked about, you know, you didn't play varsity your freshman year. And I had a brother who played hockey at Harvard the same time you were actually at Cornell. And I remember those days. They actually had JV teams, but you had in 1974, 94 points, 75, 97 points, and 76, 105 points. So you had a total of 296 career points in 3 seasons, which is absolutely insane when you think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had some really, you know, it was interesting because I was able to, you know, our coach Moran was very, very big on playing, you know, on seniority. And so I was very fortunate to start my first varsity game and play, you know, every game. The interesting thing was, is that, you know, this was back and, you know, Jack, you know, this was back when we didn't have, you know, all the long sticks. Midfielders were playing both ways. I actually faced off a lot of times for Cornell back then, usually resulting, you know, if I won the faceoff, it was good news. If I lost it, then it usually resulted in a penalty for me for my defensive or my lack thereof of defense. So, you know, you played a lot. The game was a lot different. And, you know, you didn't have as many specialty things. The odd thing was is that we had really good players that supported me, and that resulted in me obviously being successful in terms of points and all that kind of stuff. I never really was, because I played in Canada, and it's, you know, I played so many games in hockey and so many lacrosse games. Never really, you know, was that concerned about, you know, points. In fact, you know, even more interesting is that our team was really so good. You know, we never lost an Ivy League game. You know, I think we lost a couple games in my career, but our goal was to get out in the third quarter, and that would give all the other guys an opportunity to play. And, you know, we found that, and we actually would pull ourselves, you know, Eamon would do it. We'd do it. And we'd say, let's get the other guys in there. Cause some of those guys were starting when, you know, I was a sophomore, they were starting the year before. And what it really did is it really helped, I think, develop our team chemistry. And, you know, so putting all the points aside, you know, if you have all the right ingredients, it makes it a lot easier. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, Coach, I'm looking at stats. You lost 4 games and won 43 in your time at Cornell, which is ridiculous by today's lofty standards, I think. You mentioned that your attitude towards playing wasn't really like, oh, I need to get my points or something like that, and you want to be with the team and you want to have the win. I think that holds true for a lot of Canadian players that make it down to the States and play in college versus, you know, some of the more flashy, iso-dodging American offensive players in particular. What do you put that down to? Is that just the difference in the culture between, you know, guys that are hockey players and box players versus guys that come in and play lacrosse that play other sports in the States, or is it something else?
I think partly, you know, if in fact that is true. I think partly it's because most of us play minor lacrosse, minor hockey, and it's really not for your school. You're playing for, you know, the community. You're playing for, you know, I was sponsored by, Super Test gas stations, in your small community, and you play a lot of games. You play an awful lot of games. And so I think that there's not as much, in some ways, this is maybe not good, but there's not as much practice per the number of games you play. And I just think that the scoring isn't really for a lot of people. You know, I you know, the things that I wanted to be a team captain. you know, because that made me feel like my peers respected me and my coaches respected me. That was much more important than winning the scoring title. Much, much, much more important. There's just, and there's a lot of players that I think are like that. You mentioned Paul and Gary Yate, who are very good friends of mine. I'm going to see Paul on the 18th of March. The interesting thing is that, you know, they had a monumental impact on lacrosse as well. But they were essentially, when we were preparing for the 1982 World Games, which were in Baltimore, and I was on the captain of that team. We didn't fare as well in 82, unfortunately, as we did in 78. And we were trying to get a place to have our training camps. I don't know if this is news. Interrupt me if you've heard this before, but we tried, and I knew Henry Ciccaroni, I knew Buddy Beardmore, I knew Richie Moran. You know, he's my mentor, one of my greatest friends, and we tried to get all those schools to, you know, help us. Like, you know, we'd pay, the Canadian government was funding a lot of the costs, so we'd pay to stay, and we'd, you know, we wanted to use fields. We wanted to get exhibition. We couldn't get any exhibition games, obviously, in Canada because teams didn't want to go there. And, you know, all the club teams were down here. So we approached Roy Simmons. And this was when Syracuse was getting stomped by Cornell by 15 goals. You know, they were not a powerhouse. And the long and the short of it is Coach Simmons put us up, helped arrange, you know, games for us. Was unbelievably supportive because he didn't really care. He didn't have any bad taste in his mouth. He wasn't really involved with the national team. And so they put us up, and it was something that our coaches never forgot. And I remember Bobby Allen, you know, who's our coach, a dear friend of mine, saying, "Coach, you know, there may come a time in the future where I'm going to pay you back." So you know what that was? That was a phone call when these two twins were playing in Victoria, British Columbia, and saying, "You got to come and take a look at these two kids." And so ultimately, Gary and Paul, and then Tom Marichek, I think they looked at one school, Syracuse. So that's called sole sourced in the business. So, things happen for reasons, but I think a lot of the reason that Syracuse became so successful was because Roy Simmons Jr., went out of his way to help the Canadian national team.
It's a great story.
See, I told you I learned a lot. I'm excited. That's amazing. I have never heard that story, so that's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know why it isn't more. You know, I guess it's in Canadian lacrosse folklore, it's pretty well known. Coach Simmons really was very supportive of lacrosse at all levels. Everybody knows how close he's tied to the Indigenous Native American game and all that, and how many Native American players have thrived under his coaching. So it's an interesting story. And, you know, and I look at it now and you're seeing what a lot of the Canadian kids are doing now. And it really makes me feel good because, you know, I don't really care that much about the points and anything, but I really feel good when I read about a kid getting an opportunity to play at Limestone, to play at North Carolina, to play anywhere. And, you know, I see it now because, you know, my coaches and the scouts for my team, they know all these players. And, you know, I was watching Robert Morris play, I forget who they were playing, maybe Jacksonville or somebody. And it was a good game. And, you know, there's probably 15 Canadians on the two teams, maybe even more. So it's all good stuff to see that, you know, these guys can, you know, not have to work at General Motors.
It's a very good point. And I don't think a lot of people know that the national sport in Canada is what, Mike?
Well, the national summer sport is lacrosse. The national winter sport is hockey. So, you know, we kind of split the baby there. But the national summer sport is lacrosse. And so, you know, and I think that, you know, there's a guy on Cornell's team, a Canadian guy, who, you know, when I had discussions with him when he was in high school, when I could, when the coaches asked me to give him a call and talk to his dad and stuff about my experiences, he'd never played box lacrosse.
Interesting.
Wow.
And you probably know what I'm talking about, but he never played box lacrosse. He'd only play field. And I go, wow, we've come a long way.
Yeah.
Used to be the complete opposite, right?
Yeah, I think we've kind of talked a lot on the podcast in the past about the Canadian influence and how it's, especially offensively, it's really contributed to the college game and kind of almost forced the game to evolve, thrown in a shot clock, things like that. Two-man game is now the hottest thing in across all divisions is, oh, we got to run two-man game. We got to run picks. We got to run slips. We got to do this and we got to run wing offense. Have you seen all of this before? Is it really a cycle of things in the game? Because I think a lot of people, when they talk about other sports, they're like, okay, well, we were doing that back in the 80s. We were doing that back in the early 90s. And now it's fresh and new again, even though it's kind of been around.
I think that when we were playing, we had what we called a circulation offense where everybody was moving, you know, there was no ball watching, there was no standing, everybody was moving with or without the ball. And so that kind of made it conducive to, you know, bumping into each other, setting slip picks, doing that kind of stuff. We did that, but not to the extent that it's done today, just simply because now coaches really have a significant respect for the attributes that you gain from playing in a confined box, you know, area, like, you know, the way you have to react quicker, the way you have to, you know, work in a confined space. So I think that now that's pretty much common knowledge. I remember when, I guess in the mid 80s, when they started the National Lacrosse League, and, you know, we had to really rely on a lot of American players, a lot of coaches out there. I'm not going to name any names, but they were saying that you shouldn't play box lacrosse. Everybody's punching each other. It's physical. Everybody gets hurt. And a lot of these people have come a completely full circle. I'm not going to name any names, but I know because I used to talk to them because I had players that were like the fourth or fifth coach at a given school, and they wouldn't let them leave on a Friday night to go practice. You know, they had to go look at film. So I think that the game has evolved. It's a lot different. I would also kind of challenge your comment that, you know, a lot of these players are offensive players. You know, there's a lot of Canadian players that are defenders, are, you know, two-way midfielders that are really good. They now have, you know, there's been guys on Cornell. And there's one kid now that's on Cornell that, you know, is a defender that I think is going to be a really impactful player. And so, you know, you look at some of these guys that are playing now that, you know, they're not just what they call finishers. We need a lefty finisher. The Canadian guys are now playing field lacrosse in every position, even goaltenders. I think that's grown. At first, probably when I came down, they said, well, you get this guy, come down there, you can score some goals. But, you know, now I see how it's evolved. And, you know, the field game in Canada has become, you know, really popular. It's not as popular as the box game, but it's you're gaining a lot of momentum. And largely it is because people know if they play that game, if they can be proficient playing indoor and proficient playing outdoor, there's a good chance that they're going to find a place to get educated in the United States and in Canada. You know, the Canadian, you know, field leagues are getting stronger, but, you know, there's a lot of kids that I think are recognizing that it's really their ticket to getting an education.
Now, you're one of the individuals pushing forward the box movement, not just in Canada, but in the States. When you finished playing at Cornell, specifically the Philadelphia Wings, who come and go and are back again and always back and never leaving in the NLL. Also, the NLL was the MILL, as well as the Eagle Pro Box Lacrosse League. What was your experience going from a player to a coach And now you're basically a partner in one of the teams.
Well, I would say that I never really coached. I never really coached. I played in the NLL, or I guess it was called the Eagle League, for like a year and a half. I was like 36, you know, and so I wanted to play with my brother, who's 8 years younger than me. And I played for like a year and a half, but I had a job. Like I said, I got 2 degrees, so I had a pretty good job. You know, I'd gotten a green card and I would move to Philadelphia. So, I was really kind of focused, and I didn't know that the league was going to be like the NLL is today. You know, back then it was beer tickets. You know, you remember, you know, Jack, it was beer tickets. You really didn't get paid, and you get banged up pretty good now and then. So I didn't apply, when I was already kind of, in my mind, kind of done and over the hill, but I wanted to play with my brother. So I did that. And then I got the founders of the league. It was a single entity. You know, we had 4 then 6 teams at the beginning, and you know, they asked me to help out. So I kind of like ran the Philadelphia franchise because it was the most successful and profitable. When we played in the Spectrum, I became a minority partner, and we were making money. And then when we ended up at the Wells Fargo Center, which was called something else back then, when we moved there, I became the majority owner, and we were losing money. So I don't care how many degrees you have. That's not a really good formula. So I learned a little bit, you know, the hard way, because I found that, you know, it was really hard to deal with all the elements of being successful in terms of, you know, sponsorship, you know, ticket sales, merchandise, all that kind of stuff. And also win. We ended up being very successful. We won 6 championships. And, you know, the financial side of it became a little bit more stable. And then, you know, I was approached by Mohegan Sun and the Comcast Spectacor. The owner had just sold the Sixers. They had just sold the Phantoms, which is their AHL hockey team. And I said to him, hey, do you want to partner with me? And they said, you know, we're not really focusing on any teams. We're going to just the Flyers, and, you know, we're going to still manage buildings all around the country. And so when I was approached by Mohegan Sun and met with them, I said, you know what, this is going to be, we're going to be really partners. They're going to invest in 50% of the team. And so I moved the team. And then lo and behold, some new people came in at Comcast to run their building management arm, which is now called Spectra, and they had an affinity for lacrosse, and they bought a new franchise. And so they contacted me about it, and they said, you know, what do you think? Can you give us some advice? And I went down there a number of times and met with them, and because I wanted the team in Philly. You know, I gave them all the marks. I gave them all the rights, and, you know, I wanted a team back in Philly because it was a really great market. And so now they're back, and we're going to probably be battling them for a playoff spot. So, you know, I have, you know, obviously a strong appreciation for the Wings, but I hope we beat them pretty good, like we did the first game. We beat them; it was 9-8. But you know, it looks like, you know, we may be fighting for a playoff spot with them. You know, when we get down to it in April.
New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal will return after this message.
The Men's Lacrosse Championships, where speed and power meets precision and creativity. And they give it everything they got, from face-off to the final whistle. Go big for every goal. Go beyond your limits and enter the NCAA universe. The Men's Lacrosse Championships, May 28th through 30th at Rentschler Field in East Hartford, Connecticut. Get your seats today at ncaa.com/mlacrosse.
Are you serious about playing your sport in college? Do you need a flexible education that allows you to maintain your practice and competition schedules while also preparing you to succeed at the next level? You should check out the University of Nebraska High School. UNHS is accredited and offers more than 100 online courses, including NCAA-approved courses to protect your academic eligibility. Students could earn a UNHS diploma or take a single course for transfer credit. Courses are college prep, self-paced, and available 24/7, 365. Enroll anytime and take up to a year to complete a course. Visit highschool.nebraska.edu today.
Looking to keep up with all the latest news and information on New England lacrosse? New England Lacrosse Journal and LaxJournal.com are the premier resources for information and inspiration on the New England lacrosse scene. Have every issue of New England Lacrosse Journal, the magazine, delivered to your home or office. And don't forget to stay in the game every day with a digital subscription to LaxJournal.com to receive daily digital lacrosse coverage on club lacrosse, college commits, prep and high school, Division I, II, and III colleges, showcases, rankings, and much more. Get in the game and behind the scenes now by logging on to LaxJournal.com. Just click on the subscribe button and start the subscription that is right for you today. New England Lacrosse Journal is a Siemens Media publication. Siemens Media. Inspiring. Informative. Insightful.
How has the expansion worked out for this year, Mike? And does the league plan to expand going forward?
Well, I think that the we obviously have grown a lot in the last 5 or 6 years, and we've not only grown, but we've got new owners in Saskatchewan. We've got the Vancouver Canucks now own the Vancouver team. And so we've got, really better, more financially sound owners. The two new franchises, Las Vegas will be next year, but, they're experiencing the lumps that of Panther City, which is in Fort Worth. I think they're 1-7 or something like that. And New York, which I think is a very, very dangerous team, I don't think their record speaks for how good they are. I think they're 1-6 or 1-7, but I think they're doing well. I think that it probably takes maybe 2 to 3 years to ramp up as far as other, I know there's a lot of interest in a lot of other markets. We have 15 different teams and everybody has a different opinion. And, some say, hey, maybe we shouldn't expand. Maybe we should just kind of, build our ticket sales and build our league-wide sponsorship efforts. And then some say, let's get to 20 teams. So it's always an interesting time when we have our board meetings and we talk about that. I'm the chair of the expansion committee, and I'd like to see us get to 20 teams. You have to be in markets that are strong media markets, and you have to be in a situation where you have some control over your building. Because, I know what it's like to rent I did it in Philly and we're doing it now in Albany. We have a pretty favorable deal, certainly in Albany in terms of rent. But other teams that are owned by NHL hockey teams or NBA basketball teams, they don't have the same situation because for the most part, they control their building. And that helps them with, dates and there's a lot of different things. And you can share resources, obviously.
Yeah, I know that was a big problem with when the Blazers came back. That was a kind of one of the biggest difficulties there. But obviously Jack and I would love, and our audience would love, if there was a team back in New England, an indoor team. I think the appetite's there. I think it's just like you said, it's a facility kind of issue here. But I think we can figure that out. And we've got two investors right here.
There you go.
I have very little money that I'm willing to part with, but I will do it. If that's coming, I want to be a part of it. And so I'm sure.
Well, we looked at a lot of cities. When Mohegan Sun, they had a change at in their tribal leadership. They contacted me and said, hey, we just laid off like 7,500 people. We haven't been closed for an hour for 27 years. And the pandemic's, really hurting us. And we'd like to get out of our deal, basically saying that, it's a non-core asset. And because we played on Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays, they were looking ahead saying, when the pandemic's over, we can get some country and western singer, or we can get Bruno Mars, or we can get you know Barry Manilow in here, and that's going to allow us to bring in some higher yielding gaming patrons. So we said, when I was contacted by some of these guys that all played lacrosse, they're all my new partners, great guys. We would have liked to stay in New England, but it's hard because a lot of these arenas are controlled by, and unless you're partnering with an NHL team, you're going to be in there competing for sponsors, dates. And so, the interesting thing about Albany is they don't have a hockey team. They got a 16,000 seat arena without a hockey team. And I don't know how many of those opportunities there are in North America, because every arena like that I know of usually has a hockey team. So we were able to get all Saturday nights, and we were able to become the lead tenant there, which is, it's a slow process. We're still dealing with the pandemic and, getting people that want to be comfortable to come into the arena. We just, last game was the first game. We didn't have to have people masked and, showing, their vaccination card. We think it's going to be a good market. It's just going to take a little bit of time to grow and mature.
I'm curious who the best American player to play box is for you ever, and who it is right now.
Well, I'm also the chair of the Hall of Fame committee. Players that are in the Hall of Fame that are American obviously would be at the top of my list. I'm also biased because of my long time involvement with the Philadelphia Wings. But, Casey Powell's going into the Hall of Fame. The guy was an MVP in the NLL. Guy was outstanding. Kevin Finneran, who played, for us, he's got like 5 championships. He played for the Toronto Rock, the only American on the Toronto Rock. Jake Berge, I can go back to Saul Locascio, John Tucker, who played, for the Wings and is in the Hall of Fame as well. Tony Resch, who was our coach and, is in the NLL Hall of Fame. I can think of a lot of them. Now we have a bunch on our team, and, it just takes the right type of person. Like, I know that it's a significant commitment. It's a significant commitment to play in the PLL as well, but it's a significant commitment. And sometimes you don't have the bandwidth because of your job. Then it becomes your family after a while. Like Greg Downing is on our team, he just lives in Boston. I think he's as good as any defender. He's got significant skills. It took him a long time and Brett Manny, who's our captain, he's been in the league for 13, 14 years. And so there's an awful lot of them, and I'm sure I'm missing many. I think it's like even our faceoff guy, he's from Joe Nardella. He was in on the practice squad, and he can win faceoffs, but the guy can also play defense. The guy can play really solid defense, and he learned it, and he got good coaching, got great coaching, and he learned how to play the indoor game, and he's a big contributor. So I could probably, if I had rosters in front of me, I could pick out a bunch from everybody's team. You think Tom Schreiber's not good? I don't know where Toronto is without Tom Schreiber. He's a really skilled all-around lacrosse player. And if you're a really skilled field player and you want to be you want to make your field game even better and you want to play box, you'll be an even better field player and box player if you put in the time and effort and you get good coaching.
Yeah, you look what Rambo's done as well.
Rambo,
how he's
Blaze. If I had people's names in front of me, I could pick them out. But I kind of look back at the ones that have already, played a long time, and guys that have put over 10 years. My own coach, Glenn Clark. Clark played 9 years. And he's got 5 championships. he was a remarkable, you know, two-way defender. He's a guy that I think is going to ultimately be, you know, a Hall of Famer. You know, Brian Volker, you know, the coach at Drexel, played for the Wings, you know. You ask some of these guys, you ask the John Tavareses of the world and say, who gave you trouble? You know, Tavares always says Brian Volker, you know, in the battles that Buffalo and Philadelphia had back, you know, in the 90s.
Yeah, I got a great story with Tavares. We were beating Buffalo. It was 12-5 at halftime, and Tavares, something happened with his flight or whatever, and he shows up for the second half. I think we lost 14-12. He scored like 7 straight goals. It was like, oh, Tavares is in there. And then he showed up, and everyone's like, oh, no. Yeah. But he was tremendous, absolutely tremendous. And Coach, can't talk to you without mentioning a good friend of yours and one of your great teammates, and Eamon McEnany, just not only a fantastic lacrosse player, great human being, great dad, and unfortunately lost his life in 9/11.
Well, yeah, he's, you know, obviously one of my greatest friends. I'm still very close with Bonnie, his wife, and, you know, his 4 kids, and his brothers. You know, he was the youngest of 7. Just a great, you know, teammate, leader, you know, could play. You know, he was as tough. He was about 157, soaking wet, and he was as tough as anybody. And he was just a genuine, really good guy. He just did a lot of good things for people. So, you know, we talk about him all the time. We had, you know, they just honored him at, he's going to be inducted into the City Lacs Hall of Fame. They did a tribute to him. And we also, just last week, we had Coach Morant's 85th birthday party. And it was a Zoom call, and there was 400 people on the call. And so there was like 20, I was one of the guys that they asked to say something. But, you know, you don't ever go on anything like that. And Bonnie McEnany was also there. She spoke. You don't go on a call like that without, you know, people mentioning Eamon. Right. And it's funny because if you talk to guys like Max Sebald, Rob Pinnell, a lot of guys, you know, who would you want to meet? Who would you want to have lunch with, or who would you want to, you know, sit down and talk across with? All of them say Eamon. They never met him. It's really remarkable.
Who would you compare his game with to a player today playing in Division I lacrosse?
You know, he's got the same quick. He had the same quickness as Sowers, you know, and Mike Sowers is somebody I think was really quick, and they got the kid in North Carolina. I don't really think that I could, you know, pinpoint, you know, Eamon played, you know, Division I football at Cornell. He went out. He was a wide receiver. For a while there, he led the nation in yards per catch. So it's a really interesting question, but really hard for me to answer. You know, I think that there's, you know, obviously the equipment gets better, the players get physically stronger. The training, the diet, the, you know, the nutrition, the regiment gets more and more. You know, I see the lifting programs that these schools have. I know what they have at Cornell, and you know, I see a guy that watched him play in high school, and I go up to campus and see him. I go, whoa, that guy's different. He's bigger, stronger, faster, and by the way, smarter. I think you probably see that too, Jack, right?
Oh yeah, it's amazing. After that first semester, it's they show up as kids, and before you know it, they're men.
It's a full-time commitment. I don't know if they had as much fun as we did, but I think they find a way to do that. But it's, you know what, it's you got to get the right people. And so that's why I think recruiting is more about the background of the kids that coaches pick, you know, that, you know, the family, their academic prowess is obviously important, for a lot of schools, their commitment. You know, they always say he's a good fit. He's a good fit. Figuring out what a good fit is not easy, because that's not the number five guy on somebody's poll. It's not the number 50 guy on somebody's poll. It's somebody that, you know, is going to be able to contribute whether they're on the field or not.
Now, we're talking to you on the morning that NLL Commissioner Nick Sakavich has decided to pursue other opportunities. He's not going to come back and run the NLL next season. What was your experience with him as a commissioner, and you know, how does his impact kind of echo throughout the rest of what the league is going to do?
Well, you know, I was a very big supporter of Nick's, and I was on the selection committee with Corn Ferry and some of the other owners. And, you know, we were in a situation where we were possibly going from 9 to 8 teams when we hired him. And, you know, now we're at 15. So then we have television deals. We have a lot of new sponsors, you know, and we are on a pretty strong, I think, despite 2 years in the pandemic, and, you know, we added 2 teams during the pandemic, which is pretty remarkable. So, you know, I am in a lot of ways a big supporter of his, and, you know, but I understand that, you know, it's not always easy to deal with, you know, a lot of different owners. You know, it's like, you know, maybe herding cats from time to time. And, you know, I think he feels like he's accomplished a lot. What do they call it? He was a kind of a game changer, change agent. And he did all that. And I think he just, you know, wants to do something else. And the good thing is that we have a pretty good support system with Jessica Berman and her experience with the National Hockey League. And, you know, so I think that we'll probably go through a process. But Jessica is, you know, I have, you know, significant confidence in her capabilities. And, you know, these people are all wired. Now we have owners that are, you know, they're all wired to the other leagues. So if we're going to talk to another owner about, and maybe he has an NBA team, or maybe he has a WNBA team, maybe he has an NHL team, maybe he's got some other professional sports that are in his portfolio. All our guys know them, all our owners from Colorado to Calgary to, you know, to Joe in San Diego and Las Vegas. But they all know these people. So we have an infinite amount of intelligence. And, you know, we got people like Jessica, and we had Nick that, you know, were in the MLS. And Jessica, she can pick up the phone and call Gary Bettman anytime she wants for advice. Or what do you think of, you know, this particular NHL organization. So Nick really, you know, had a lot to do with that. And, you know, I wish him well. I wish him well. And, you know, he'll find a challenge that he'll take on. And, you know, he's a game changer. And most of the changes that we've had over the last 6 years, and he's been the point person for, have been, you know, pretty significant. And I think that he's done a lot of the heavy lifting here. You know, a lot of the heavy lifting's been done, and I give him a lot of credit for the growth that we've had.
Mike, last question, went out of time. How far away do you think we are having full-time indoor lacrosse players? Is that something
I would say full-time lacrosse players, because, you know, I love the PLL. I love the PLL. And, you know, I don't know how long it'll be, you know, a touring league. You know, I've heard some rumors that it might, you know, they might settle in different markets. But I think the combined, you know, PLL and indoor, I think that there's got to be a way we can get these people moving to markets. And, you know, making it a full-time gig. For a lot of guys, it is a full-time gig because they have, you know, Jack, you know much better than I do. They have their camps, their clinics, their teams. And so they can make, you know, money. Brett Manning at NXT and, you know, your organization, you see it. You have kids that are working for you. You can do that. But in terms of just playing, you know, I hope we're close. I hope that by the time we get to 20 teams, you know, and we get, you know, a significant media rights deal, hopefully we'll have a significant media rights deal, because all the boats have to rise at the same time. In order for the players to get paid more, we have to have, you know, more revenue sources, more income sources in the league. And a lot of that comes with, you know, certainly ticket sales and, you know, how individual teams do, but also, you know, league-wide sponsorships and how we do with television and, you know, some of these other major endemic and non-endemic sponsors that support the league. So I think it's, you know, I think it's out there. I would like to see it happen sooner versus later and, you know, be collaborative, which I think it will be with the other league. But you know, I wouldn't want to bet on the timing.
Right. Well, that's good to hear. Well, Mike, thanks so much for your time today. It's really been a lot of fun having you on, and hopefully I'll see you at Big Red Lacrosse game sooner than later.
Yeah, you might see me at Lehigh, because my team's playing in San Diego, and although I'd probably be smart to go out and enjoy some of the weather in San Diego, I got a few other things that are keeping me here in Pennsylvania. But I got a couple of calls already about, you know, am I going to go to Lehigh? So I'm going to try to figure that out and go see the Big Red play and watch the Piatelli boys.
Very good. Hopefully I'll see you there, because I will be there. And we've waited 2 years too long for this. And again, yeah. Thanks so much for your time, Mike.
All right. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks for coming on. What a story about the Gate Brothers.
Yeah, I've never heard that story before. Very interesting. Roy Simmons Jr. went out of his way for the Canadian team to find him a field, places to play, practice, play other teams. And the Canadians rewarded him with Gary and Paul Gate.
You know, those Canadians, they're all very polite. They return favors. And that's almost more of a return for Syracuse in the end, especially now. Listen, Gary Gate, the head coach at Syracuse, who would have thought that that kind of interaction would have such a ripple effect across the game and people wouldn't even know about it? It's like a stone that someone threw into this giant well, and it produced all these ripples. And, you know, it was... honored to have even been on a podcast where that was explained, because it's actually groundbreaking. I think he prefaced the story saying, like, I think people have heard the story before, and my jaw hit the ground as he was telling it. So I don't think that many people have heard it before.
No, I agree with that. And Maracek, also another Canadian, great influence at Syracuse during that time. It continues with all the Canadian players having the opportunity, like you said, playing at the Division I, II, and III level.
It got a little snippy when I was like, yeah, you can play offense, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's like, no, we play defense, and, you know, we have all these guys, and he just listed them off. So, you know, I learned my lesson there.
Yeah, but your point was really, you know, saying that they changed the offensive style of play. They, you know, one-handed lefties, righties, and they just... the way they move the ball and shoot the ball. It's just they really opened a number of American coaches and players' eyes, because they just played it like they were playing box. Very different.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many times coaching box during the winter that I just screamed two hands. More than two hands on your stick, two hands on your stick. And you know who you never have to yell that at? A Canadian player. Because they never do that. Because they know what we all try to teach younger kids is you can't make a play with one hand on your stick. You need two hands. You need the lever to get the ball to move. So that was an amazing talk with a legend of the game. You know, I'm just really glad we had him on. All right. Thanks again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piatelli, I'm Kyle Devitt. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Also, listen to the podcast on the website, laxjournal.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at NELaxJournal, Instagram at New England Lacrosse Journal, Lax Journal on Facebook, and our email address, chasingthegoal@laxjournal.com. Join us again next time as we go chasing the goal. Chasing the Goal, a Siemens Media podcast.